Hello everybody and welcome to the latest edition of The Front Page. My name is Lee Muttersed. I'm joined in Racing Post HQ Studios by Chris Cook and Liam Head, and we have tons to talk about, not least the Racing Post Weighing Room expose that we featured last week and our poll to find out your jumps horse of the year. We saw some cracking jumps horses over the weekend at Ayr. It was a Scottish Grand National Festival. We had some great flat racing too at Newbury and elsewhere. And we'll start the programme, guys, by looking at the weekend. And firstly, Ayr, which ended its Grand National Festival, or peaked, with a Coral Scottish Grand National in which Harry Cobden went sensational on Captain Cody, won it for Willie Mullins, who had the first and second, and ended, therefore, the day with Willie Mullins basically levels with Dan Skelton in the Trainers' Championship. Chris, as a proud Scotsman, we'll come to you first about the Scottish Grand National.
Is that what I'm being today?
Absolutely,
all right,
yes,
okay,
yes, definitely.
Let me think my way into that character.
I spoke to one proud Scotsman in the paddock before the race who was hoping that Willie Mullins could win it for Ireland and therefore for Scotland, because it wasn't England, in the sense of Dan Skelton.
Blimey, yeah.
Absolutely.
That is how a proud Scotsman is supposed to think.
Yes. But before we talk about the race itself, the Scottish Grand National, the Trainers' Championship, because that's going to be the big narrative as we go through the final 2 weeks of the jump season. Dan Skelton had a great Friday, three winners at Ayr, and Willie had a pretty bad Saturday, had a terrible Saturday before the Scottish Grand National. Scottish Grand National, in the champion early horses, were nowhere to be seen. And he ran
four, didn't he? And they were all unplaced.
Sixth, seventh, eighth and fell. So he mopped up £2,330 from the Scottish champion hurdle, which was only a tiny little move into Dan's lead. But so at the end of it, he's almost level. Spoke after the race and how much he was enjoying the title battle, how he'll be going everywhere now. We've already seen, as we talk on Monday morning, he's entered horses for Cheltenham, or declared horses for Cheltenham on Wednesday. He's talking about running horses at Plumpton over Easter in their valuable races. And then obviously towards Sandown, Perth as well, I guess. He's going to win, isn't he?
I've been taking that for granted. It's interesting, he's still not in front, despite being sevens on to win the title again.
And Saturday could have been worse for Dan.
Yeah.
In the sense that Willie could have had the first, second in the Scottish Champion hurdle. Or
if Dan somehow pulls this out the fire, we're all going to feel pretty stupid for not taking the 9-2 while he was still in front. But I mean, his lead has gone from six figures on Saturday morning to four figures now. I mean, it's just, you know, it's like a novice hurdle away from Willie being in front, so you would think he's going to win. I was looking ahead to the entries for the Bet365 Gold Cup, and the difference in quality between what Willie's got and what Dan's got in there is just, you know, really significant. But, you know, of course they won't all run. I would think, you know, some of them have just been running this weekend and they won't be ready to go again. But the winners in the Bet365 Gold Cup, again, I don't know if you give any indication about whether you'd bring him back, but I mean, the way he won, you'd have to think he's you know, a country mile ahead of where he should be ratings wise.
And that race could suit him as well.
I was absolutely shocked to see the way he was able to quicken on that run and at the end of a 4 mile race.
Yeah, it was an amazing performance. I'll say a bit more about him in a second. But also on that Bet365 date, Sandown, there's a three graded races. If you assume that, John Bond will be a hot favourite winning, Liam, your horse, John Bond, for the celebration chase. But there's also that select hurdle in the Oaksy chase.
Yeah.
Those sort of grade two conditions races, Willie Mullins is bound to have more obvious contenders for those races than Dan, with the best one in the world. That's fair, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I don't really see a path to victory for Dan. And plus, you get the impression with some of his horses that they've done enough for the year. I mean, he's been campaigning his horses vigorously, as of course you're supposed to, through the whole of the season. And I just don't think he's got much left. Whereas, you know, Willie starts a bit later than most of the big time trainers. You know, he sort of starts winning big time in December, doesn't he? Towards the second half of December. And he's, you know, he's always bearing in mind that he's got to make his team last to Fairy House and then punch us down. So he's got loads of horses that are still, you know, ready to run the race of their lives. I would think he's home for all money.
Liam, Chris uses that great phrase, path to victory, which I normally associate more with David Dimbleby on election nights in the BBC.
That's the gig I'm angling for, yeah.
And you'd be great at it too.
Thanks, mate.
Do you see a path to victory for Dan Skelton, or is he basically doomed?
I think, well, considering, obviously, speaking on Monday, we don't know how he will get on at Warwick today. Obviously, he's got a few runners there, but Willie Mullins has obviously got the firepower. We've seen how he's been eating away at Dan Skelton's lead. I think he was 1.3 million behind before Aintree, and in the space of 2 weeks, he's cut it down to absolutely nothing. By the time Cheltenham, I think Willie's got two runners in the first race at Cheltenham. It's worth £20,000. So come 1:35 on Wednesday at Cheltenham, he could be ahead, and you would really find it hard for Dan to sort of find a way back into this title race. Having said that, he's done so well to sort of keep him at bay for this long, given the fact that he had no runners in the Grand National at Aintree, and things have, he had a treble at Ayr on Friday, but Saturday didn't go to plan. But he's been ticking away nicely, and you do have to feel for him because he's had such a tremendous season, and at the end of it, he might not get the title that he long craved for, but it's enthralling battle between the two of them.
And that's a good point in itself. Say Willie after the race on Saturday was saying how he was pleased that this is giving those final few weeks of the season an extra plot line that people, he said people always enjoy, he always enjoys championships more when they go to the wire, although I'm sure that's not the situation. The Irish Traders' Championship, I'm sure Gordon Elliott would love it if it was going to the wire, but Willie dominates that so much. But it is great, isn't it, that at tracks like Plumpton next week and at Perth, this will all be boiling on, and it gives those meetings an extra fizz.
Yeah, and it's great for the track as well, because you know they might not get huge crowds throughout all year round, but for when there's such sort of high rewards at stake in these events, it's great to see. You know, hopefully they'll get bumper crowds in, because these top horses, these top trainers are going to be firing on all cylinders, trying to get every ounce of prize money possible.
I mean, there's two ways of looking at this, because I did hear from somebody who was sort of involved in one of the runners on Saturday, just a little bit put off by the fact that suddenly there were all these horses, quality horses coming over from Ireland that 2 weeks ago you wouldn't have expected to be there. Mm. They were going to make it so much harder to get a share of the prize money. And you know, I find myself looking at the form of some of the Willie horses in the Scottish National, fully expecting that I'd be tempted to back at least two of them. Having been writing for weeks about how, you know, there's no better source of value in racing than the Willie Mullins second or third string or fourth string.
Yeah.
And I sort of, it's a mistake, isn't it, in those circumstances to look at the form and judge the horses on that. Because I ended up thinking, well, actually, I don't think any of these are going to win. And I backed Flash to Tuzin instead and got my comeuppance with one and two.
And you're not alone, because the market has no idea. Look at Nick Rocket for the Grand National.
Yeah.
Big drifter on the day. Captain Cody drifted out through Saturday, then was back in again before the race. None of us really know. I don't suppose he knows either.
The first and third in the Grand National were 33-1.
Yeah.
Extraordinary stuff. And he doesn't have to know, does he? He doesn't have to be a tipster on top of being the greatest jumps trainer there's ever been.
Speaking after race, we talk about, I was saying to him, you know, which of these meetings between now and Sandown will you be going to yourself? You know, because you're clearly enjoying this. Just one thing he said that I thought was a really good insight into his mindset. He said, I worry about tomorrow when I wake up in the morning. I just work day by day. I don't work till a week in advance because I find that curtails me. I love this next line. It's easier to change a decision if no one knows what you're thinking of doing. So if you don't tell people what you're planning, you can change your mind, and they don't know you've changed your mind in the first place. And it does sort of sum up how he works, doesn't it? Because we often don't know a week or two out whether Lossie Mouth is going to go for a champion hurdle or a Mers hurdle. You know, he does.
And he sort of gets a pass on that, doesn't he? Because everyone goes, well, that's just the way he does it.
That's the way he works. Yeah. And I don't think he's doing it to intentionally deny us information. It's just the way that works best for him.
Whereas another trainer, you know, having said, you know, this horse is going for such and such a race, feels obliged to turn up even though the ground's gone against them. There you go. Well, I think from the point of view of the spectator of the sport, you like to have an inkling, don't you? It would be difficult if everyone behaved like that. But it works for him, right?
It definitely works for him. So did Harry Cobden. Jeez, Liam, that was one hell of a ride. I'd done the big read with him, in which I'd eulogised at how great he was from the front at Aintree and Cheltenham. He didn't ride from the front on Captain Cody.
No, it was a tremendous ride, and it just shows his capabilities of what a top jockey he is. And brilliant spare ride to pick up on the horse as well. It was very interesting, the instructions he was given before the race by Willie Mullins.
Yes.
Given he was told to sort of almost impersonate a female voice.
Like a girl.
Because obviously the horse has gone so well for Jodie Towne in the past. So that was that brought a bit of humour to the post race analysis. But brilliant ride, and you know he really knows when to time things in big races, doesn't he?
I thought he'd overdone it for sure.
That final fence way.
I mean, he didn't quite get it right, did he?
No, and, it was further behind leaving the final fence than when it went into the final
fence. Yeah. And you know, as a punter, that's what you always worry about in that situation. If I had somehow had enough insight to back the blooming horse, I'd have been doing my crunch at that point. You know, you want the jockey to have it won by the last obstacle, don't you?
But he still barely tickled him after the final fence, and
the response. And in fairness, I mean, he's running down Clark Kent, isn't he? Who's not a fast horse.
Yes.
But still, that was amazing.
Denying lots of Superman headlines, had that horse gone and won. Chris, it was my first time. You'd have been there loads of times. I've never been before. I went there for 2 days, really enjoyed it. It was a tremendous buzz on Saturday. Loads of young people there as well. You know, for all that we fret about the demographic of horse racing, lots of young people are having a great time on Saturday. But it would be wrong to say the Scottish National was an easy watch this year, because it wasn't.
No, there was an awful lot of horses hitting the deck, wasn't there? And then, very sad news that two horses did not survive the race. So that was tough. I mean, it did cross my mind afterwards. It's not really a race that I've worried about in terms of its conditions in the past. But you know how people talk about the Grand National, maybe it should be run earlier in the year when you can get softer ground. I think at Aintree, they're very well supplied with watering facilities, and they can make it work. It was unusually warm this year. But the Scottish National, where it's placed, if you get a bit of dry weather on the west coast of Scotland this time of year, that course dries out pretty quick, and it's hard to keep the moisture in there.
And they had been doing, they're watering all the time. They've been constantly watering.
I'm sure they saw the risk coming and managed it as best they could. Maybe that's a race that you could move it a little bit earlier and have a better chance of safer conditions. But I mean, obviously the race then as a spectator event becomes so much less attractive. If you're running at the end of February or even in early March, you know, you're not going to get the sort of weather that will drag everyone out from Glasgow.
No.
But I mean, I'm sure that makes such a difference to that race, having a little bit of slower ground and a bit more give in the ground if you happen to fall on it.
Yeah.
It's a tight track as well, so that, you know, if something falls in front, you're an obvious risk of horses getting brought down. It worked out badly on Saturday. It was a pity.
Yeah. Liam, you were at Newbury for the two-day trials meeting. Looked, watching it from afar, that this year some of those trial races had produced more in terms of future interest than they occasionally do. The Greenham winner was impressive. The Fred Darling winner was impressive. And away from the two big established trials, there were some really encouraging performances as well.
There was, and you know, there's that many trials now for these classics, you never know really which one's going to sort of pinpoint you in the right direction. But I think on Saturday we seen in the Fred Darling and the Greenham, obviously, that, you know, usual trials for the 1,000 and 2,000 guineas respectfully, we've seen two really good winners. From the former in the 1,000 guineas, Archie Watson seems to have unearthed quite a gem.
Duty First
obviously won very impressively. Bit of a shock, obviously, 33-1. Nobody obviously fancied her chances before the race, but you know, she tore apart that field and obviously was given a great ride under Holly Doyle. Interestingly, not in the 1,000 guineas at the minute, but after the race, Archie Watson was said that that's very much the plan to supplement her. Obviously, connections will have to stump up that fee, but and they obviously must be confident she'll be able to take an improvement for the step up in trip. So she was, you know, she was pretty impressive on the day from that yard, and obviously in the Greenham, Andrew Balding with John Kill, in who is in the 2,000 guineas and has obviously taken quite a plunge in his price, because he won impressively as well.
Which of the two do you like most, Chris?
He's a typical Sir Michael improver, isn't he, that horse? Even though Sir Michael is no longer the one doing the improving.
Yeah. Can you see either of them as guineas winners?
Yeah, I mean, definitely maybe Jonquil. I mean, Greenham doesn't have the sort of record that maybe us old-timers imagine. You know, Franco was the last one to do the double. But you could see him doing it.
Could you?
Duty First. You look at the pedigree and you think the reality here is that this is a sprinter in disguise. Yeah. I mean, it's always so tempting, isn't it, after these 7 furlong trials to go just a little bit further.
Yeah.
You know, surely you just need dry ground and it'll work. And then so often it doesn't. But of course, you've got to have a go. You know, having won the Fred Darling like that, my goodness. You know, you get, is it 2 or 3 weeks full of hope?
Yeah, 3 weeks. I think it was an extra week now between. Usually.
You can't buy that experience, you know.
No.
But I think, you know, sprint races are going to be a good option if that doesn't work out.
Gethin was impressive on Friday. Derby horse?
For Owen Burrows, certainly. That's very much the plan that Owen was speaking after the race. I mean, he's been nothing but impressive in his two starts. He obviously won at Nottingham, I think, last year on quite heavy ground.
It was heavy, yeah.
So to go and put in that performance at the complete other end of the spectrum on lightning quick ground just shows you the versatility he's got and how much he can improve. Owen Burrows is such a shrewd trainer, so why not go for the Derby?
Yeah. He still looked like a horse who was learning the job, didn't he?
Yeah.
You know, he found himself in front and he was sort of having a look around.
Yeah.
He's exciting. And I mean, I think he comes from a stable that is still a little bit unexposed. You know, people haven't quite latched on to how good Owen is and access to the material that he's got as well. He is getting some good horses to play with.
And not purely Shadwell horses either. There was that time when he was so associated with Shadwell, but these days he's getting lots of good horses from elsewhere. Charlie Appleby is someone who only trains for one operation, Godolphin. And Chris, you referenced in the Cook review today that his new breed runners didn't necessarily give you confidence.
It's small sample stuff, right? We're basically talking about three horses that ran in the group races at Newbury on Saturday. But it's not like they drifted. You know, they all started between 2-1 and 11-4. And they were all unplaced. So it's just a straw in the wind as we go into the Craven meeting. But that's not what I was expecting to see anyway. And I think, you know, at least for day one, you're approaching his horses with caution as a punter, waiting to see what happens. You know, maybe it means nothing. But at this time of year, because, you know, inevitably some stables are going to be more forward than others.
Yes.
That's the kind of clue that you're looking for, isn't it?
On the other flips, on this side of that, Liam, great Saturday for Lambourne.
It was,
Your adopted home.
Yeah.
And a big week for Lambourne too, coming forward.
Yeah, no, it was great to see, I think, a reference to one of our colleagues, you know, during the day on Saturday, that every horse that won on Saturday, the seven races, was locally trained. Obviously, Andrew Balding, four-timer, incredible four-timer. But, you know, the likes of William Muir and Chris Grassick got a nice winner. Jonathan Portman had a great winner as well. And then on Friday as well, like we touched on Owen Burrows, Richard Hughes and Clive Cox both won. So, and Archie Watson, of course, won one of the big trials races. So, fantastic time for the village at the minute. And an important week. We've got the Lambourne Open Day on Friday, Good Friday. It's a tremendous event if you've not been to it before. I think there's 21 racing stables. It's completely open the doors up to the public and you can get up close and personal with these equine stars and these top trainers. And it's just a day for the family. Obviously, it unfortunately had to be cancelled last year due to the weather. Hopefully that won't be the case this year given the dry spell we've had. But, you know, it's a day for the family. Everyone comes out in the numbers. They get up to 10,000 people. And they also have afternoon activities on with the likes of AP McCoy, Nico de Boinville, all get involved in all the fun. So it is a really great day.
Yeah, absolutely. If you have been for, go again because it is a great day. That was part one of the front page. When we come back, we'll be looking at our expose into the shocking state of some British weighing rooms. Hello everyone, welcome back to the front page. I'm Lee Mottershead, I'm joined by Chris Cook and Liam Head, and we're now going to talk about the Racing Post special report that we ran last week over 2 days into the state of some British racecourse weighing rooms and the facilities that jockeys are facing on a daily basis. It came as a result of the Professional Jockeys Association, which represents jockeys, coming to the Racing Post with some picture evidence and video evidence of the state of some weighing rooms. On Thursday in the Racing Post, he ran a front page picture of Lorcan Williams using a warm-up bike in the toilets at Bath in between urinals and toilet cubicles. We had other pictures across the 2 days which show cramped facilities for female jockeys and situations like mould and plaster peeling off walls in racecourse changing rooms. The changing rooms should have been improved by now across the board in Britain. There was a weighing room project that was set up late in 2021 that was due to conclude in October 2024. Instead, only 15 racecourses have completed the modernisations, and some are expected to go on with theirs until 2030. As a result, the PGA's patience has snapped and they are calling on all racecourses to complete the work by the end of next year. Racecourses, understandably, for perhaps say that their financial situation means that is difficult for them and they want to phase it through. But we have a situation to say where jockeys are saying enough is enough. Chris, lots to talk about on this one. One of the things that emerged from the report is female jockeys repeating that they still, in 2025, have to use male changing rooms to do the job on an equal footing as men. The Racecourse Association makes the point that whilst this work is ongoing, at those racecourses that haven't done the work, and where they have done the work, what we have is a really effective neutral valet area where you've got the male changing room, the female changing room, and whereas now the valets are based in the male changing room, they're in this neutral area where female and male jockeys both come to work with their valets. The interim measure should be that all racecourses have somewhere where female jockeys can see valets outside of the male changing room.
Yeah.
But that just doesn't work.
Not practical, is
it? No, the RCA says if all jockeys follow the interim measures, there isn't a safeguarding problem. But the interim measures don't work. Female jockeys have told us that. Yeah. Because if you're in a situation at a racecourse that has, Hayley Turner referenced one, that has a bell, where the female jockeys are supposed to ring the bell for the valet to come out to see them. Well, she makes a point that if the valet's got loads of male jockeys to look after and one female jockey, they can't expect him to come out.
So they have sort of 19th century drawing room,
absolutely,
isn't it? A little tinkle on the bell and your man comes to help you.
Exactly that. So that's a rotten situation. And it's still the case that even now in 2025, after Rachel Blackmore, Holly Doyle, Hayley Turner, the growth of female jockeys as real racing stars, that lots of female jockeys have to cope with cramped facilities, really tiny broom cupboard like rooms that are in a state that isn't as good as the male facilities. Hayley referenced that Lingfield, their changing room has a drainage smell that Lingfield has been unable to fix. So you're working in there when you smell.
That was up there with the top three most horrifying details in this two-day expose, wasn't it? I mean, and you can bet that if that sort of drainage problem was existing underneath the owners and trainers' facilities, they'd have found a way to fix it by now.
The same with mould.
Yeah.
If a racecourse has mould in a public-facing area, it would surely get it fixed. In a weighing room, it doesn't get it fixed.
So, I mean, what we're seeing here is a kind of clash between the way racing presents itself in public and the way things really are in private. You know, we talk about making the jockeys the star.
Yeah.
You know, they're the ones who are going to help bring in a new audience for the sport. But, you know, realistically, it doesn't appear that we're treating them like professional athletes, never mind stars. And we also talk at great length about how racing is the one sport where men and women compete on equal terms, and clearly women are working at a significant disadvantage in terms of the facilities that are available to them. It's a hangover from the days that you and I remember sort of 40 or 50 years ago when, you know, it was basically all blokes and, you know, there were just a few women trying to get into the game. And they were toiling with, you know, broom cupboards and, you know, a caravan or literally, you know, whatever could be cobbled together as an available space for them. And the situation has only improved slowly and by increments. And it's still a long way short of equality, isn't it? I can't help feeling that the situation jockeys face is a sort of, it's like a 300-year culture in the making, isn't it? You know, they've always been at the bottom of the power structure in horse racing. Owners matter enormously, trainers also very powerful, and jockeys, you know, are expected to be grateful for everything they get. And it's taking us a long time to get to the point where they're going to be treated seriously, you know, as they should, as they deserve. It's very interesting to see some jockeys putting their names to quite significant critical quotes in your articles, because that hasn't been the way.
No.
I mean, even quite well-established jockeys have been very cheery about doing anything that might be seen as rocking the boat in the past. So I'm glad to see them speaking up in their own cause, because they do deserve better.
Yeah, they do. Liam, you race a lot. You talk to race courses, and it is the case that they do face severe financial pressures. Affordability checks have had a big impact on them, and things like national insurance rises are a significant factor. You've got tracks, jumps tracks with small fields that's impacting their media rights payments. So lots of reasons, and also you've got tracks with peculiar issues like Kelso with its historic listed building that can't easily be touched. But in a wider sense, one of the points I've made today in the column is that if you have a set amount of money to spend, which a lot of racecourses are clearly in that position, ultimately it's about deciding where your priorities lie in terms of where you spend the money. And what we've seen is that in a lot of cases, the welfare of jockeys, the participants, the athletes, has not been deemed to be a sufficiently important priority to prioritise this work.
Yeah, and that's the way you say that is it's shocking, really, because they are supposed to be they are elite athletes. You know, this would not happen in any other sport. Like we've touched on, the men and the women riders, they're competing off the same level playing field. You know, it's one of the only very few sports that this case happens, and that. The treatment they're getting wouldn't happen in any other sport. I just touch on football, for example. If a football club gets promoted from non-league football into the football league and the stadium isn't up to standards, they have to put the work in, otherwise they can't go up. Yeah. And it's happened in the past where they've not had the facilities to be able to go up to that next level. In this case, you know, there should be pressure put on these racetracks. I get that, you know, they've had difficulties with funding and things like that, but the facilities for the jockeys should be second to none. It should be fantastic for them, because they are the bread and butter of the sport. You know, they are the stars along with the horses, and they need to have the treatment they deserve to ensure that they're going to the race courses and they're having to feel relaxed in between each races. I mean, the picture we've seen of Lorcan Williams on the front of the Racing Post the other day, you don't even have to read into too much. You look at the picture, tells a thousand words,
absolutely,
doesn't it?
Absolutely.
I mean, for a random person, you could bring that newspaper and show it to anyone who doesn't watch horse racing, and it tells a story. And it's shocking, because this is a professional sport with elite athletes, and they are getting that sort of treatment. And like you said, it's not just that picture. I mean, Tom Marquand spoke to one of our colleagues about how it's not just that picture that's the issue. There's obviously mould, there's space issues, and the treatment between men and women in the space in the changing room. So something needs to happen, and it is reassuring, like Chris said, that more jockeys are speaking up about it, because the more people talk about it, then the more likely these things have to happen.
And I mean, I thought it was a very interesting point in your article today. There's money available. Okay, it's not free money. It comes in the form of a loan.
Yeah.
But it's a loan on, you know, very repayable terms, you know, over a long period of time. I think 10 years, wasn't
it? Yeah, 10 years, Bank of England base rates.
And yet, only, was it 12 million has been taken out of an available 40 million?
No, worse than that. So the levy board has put forward £20 million of loan funding for this particular project. £12.5 million of that came from the levy board's own funds.
Right.
And the levy board had to borrow £7.5 million from the Racing Foundation to take the £20 million, because it had been advised that there will be significant desire to use it. And yet, only four racecourses have utilised that loan funding. So only £1.6 million of the £20 million has been used. And that at some point, government will want to know why. Because with a statutory body like the Levy Board using racing, or taking a loan from the Racing Foundation, it has to talk to government and say, well, we want to do this, we want to take on this debt, because we have been advised that this project is deemed to be so important within racing, as it is, and there will be significant uptake of the loan option. And it hasn't been taken up, apart from those four race courses.
It's just an incredible situation, isn't it, when you've simultaneously got tracks that are years past the original deadline and don't have plans in place and are worried about funding, and the money's there. You know, why isn't it being taken up? It's extraordinary.
And one other thing that I think is regrettable that we're referencing in the column today is that we know that even in the current governance model, the BHA lacks power. It's still held back by vested interests within the industry. It doesn't seem to be able to run the sport in the way plenty of people would like it to do. But as well as a governing body, it's a regulator. Mm. And where a regulator does have the power to regulate, the BHA has significant regulatory powers. It uses those in terms of licensing participants, but also has at its disposal the power to license racecourses. And what we've seen here is, again, frustration from the participants, from jockeys, that while they have to jump through a lot of hoops to get and maintain their licenses, they look at racecourses and say, well, look, the BHA, you regulate racecourses. They haven't ticked this box, well, not ticked, but they haven't met this standard that they're supposed to have met in terms of racecourse weighing rooms. Some will be very late, and yet you're still giving them fixtures. So that, for me, is a disappointment. The BHA has been too meek in regulating racecourses, certainly relative to the confidence with which it regulates participants.
And you're left with a clear impression, aren't you, that racecourses, while they say, well, we're willing to invest in this, but we're going to do it on our own terms. You know, we're going to do other things that we think are more important right now, and we, you know, we'll get to that one day. You know, it's a disappointing attitude. I mean, I as a kid, I was given a copy of a book called Bedside Racing by Willie Carson. Right. It was published in 1982. And I clearly remember a lot of the complaints that are being made now were being made then about the inadequacy of the facilities. So the British economy not in a brilliant space right now, but since 1982, there have definitely been points when things were going well and racing was awash with money. Unfortunately, we failed to mend the roof while the sun was shining. And now we're left dealing with this problem that should have been dealt with decades ago, whilst money is short and no one to blame but ourselves. It's a problem that's been too long in the addressing.
It has, yeah. I suppose the hope now, the PGA's hope, was by coming to Racing Post and trying to publicly embarrass racecourses, that it might cause racecourses to act faster and it might cause the BHA to regulate harder. I guess very quickly we've had some positivity in that Bangor have changed their situation, whereby they put up a marquee with bikes in there. There will then be a porter cabin for bikes until they do their proper modernisation work. So that is the hope, that by really bringing this to a different level in terms of public exposure, that something might happen.
Well, there's always hope, eh?
Yes, there is always hope. And there is also right now a poll to determine your Jumps Horse of the Year. Yes, the Racing Post is this year organising the poll to determine who is the racing fans' jump source of 2025. You can vote for that at racingpost.com/horse of the year. I'll remind you of that in a second. Five horses are fighting to be crowned the champion of the 2024-5 season. They are, he looks down, Galopin Deschamps, I Know the Way You're Thinking, John Bon, Lossy Mouth, and Nick Rocket. So, Liam, we'll come to you first. Liam, Mr. Lamborn, great friend and ally of Nicky Henderson, trainer of John Bon. Who's your horse of the year?
I'm going to go straight in with John Bon.
Are you?
I have to. I mean, listen, he's aside from the start that he got at Cheltenham, that obviously seemingly affected him in the race, in the champion chase, he was brilliant. He barely put a foot wrong. Won 4 out of 5. He was stunning at Aintree. I just think he's just the ultimate racehorse.
Okay, so just like the Eurovision Song Contest, Chris, tactical voting from Mr. Head, voting for his friend and neighbour.
No, I think he really believed that.
Do you think so? Okay. And to be fair, John, but aside from, you said he didn't put his foot wrong, he did put his feet wrong at that fence at Cheltenham, which was the problem.
Yeah.
But a very solid horse. Very high class horse, only ever loses when he runs at Cheltenham, and sometimes he wins there too. Does he deserve to be horse of the year?
John Bon? No. Yeah. I mean, I think you're going to be jumps horse of the year, you've got to have won at Cheltenham or Aintree, don't you, really?
He did win at Aintree.
Yeah, okay.
He didn't win at Cheltenham.
I was thinking of the Grand National. You've got to win at Cheltenham or the Grand National.
Okay. So winning the Merton Novice Hurdle isn't enough.
I'm making up the rules as I go along.
That's fine, you're allowed.
So I think only two in the list actually won at Cheltenham.
Yes, so Gallop Anderson didn't. I know the way you're thinking did. John Bond didn't. Lossy Mouth did, albeit not in the race and wanted to be in.
Not in the race he should have been in. So it's got to be another way you're thinking. I mean, apart from the fact that the others have issues. Yeah. He was a really impressive Gold Cup winner. He's beaten a really impressive dual Gold Cup winner. Yeah. He's a proper horse. You could worry about the fact that, you know, he's a sort of one race horse this season, isn't he? You know, the rest of his season was kind of building up gradually towards that amazing performance. But it was an amazing performance. And I think, you know, long after the rest of the season might have faded away, that's the thing that we'll still remember.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree with you. I mean, Gallop Anderson was amazing at Leopardstown twice over the winter, but maybe because he was so amazing at Leopardstown twice, he was a bit less amazing at Cheltenham.
Yep.
And I agree with you. I think the Gold Cup is the holy grail. That's the day you really have to deliver if you're that sort of horse. And I thought, I know the way you're thinking, was a superb winner of the Gold Cup. He maybe hadn't showed us that through the winter, but on the day that mattered.
That was what made it so thrilling. It was like a revelation of the extent of his talent, wasn't it? I mean, if you vote for Gallopan in a poll like this, it's a sort of lifetime achievement award, isn't it? You know, he got beat in the day when they really, really wanted him to win, so I don't think he can win this poll either.
No.
But I mean, Nick Rockett will get a lot of fans as well because people love a Grand National winner.
Yeah, they do.
It slightly pulls him down that nobody backed him, you know, unfortunately.
Yes, two votes in this room for I Know The Way You're Thinking. One for John Bond, but undoubtedly Lossy Mouth, Nick Rockett and Gallop Anderson will have their supporters. You have until midday on Monday, April the 21st to vote. The winner will be announced on the Jumps finale day at Sandown the following Saturday. And one lucky voter will win two tickets for that fantastic afternoon at Sandown. Oh, sorry. Liam has just written down on the pad, racingpost.com/horse. The producer was adamant, I get this right, racingpost.com/horse of the year. Only said it now about four times. Got to be a good thing. Must have earned brownie points for that. This is the end of the programme. Thank you for watching. Thank you to Chris. Thank you for Liam. And we will be back next Saturday, when you might have still an hour or so to vote, but basically, do it now. Bye-bye.